What I would like to do first is a very quick run through about acid-base chemistry. Because if we're going to be doing buffer problems, we got to make sure that we know what we know about acid-base chemistry. Now, I don't recall, we haven't done any discussion really about acids and bases so far this quarter, have we? No. So, there are three definitions of acids and bases you have probably learned about in the past. There is the Arrhenius definition, the Bronsted-Lowry definition, and the Lewis definition of acids and bases. Does anybody remember what the Arrhenius definition of acids and bases is? Yes? So an acid produces H+, and a base produces OH minus, and it produces it by dissociation. In other words, those two things have to be in the compounds themselves. An acid dissociates to produce H+. A base dissociates to produce OH minus. Why do we have this definition of acids and bases? Why call an acid something that makes H plus? Why call a base something that makes H plus? What are those two things related to? There is this pH thing that we'll talk about in just a second. What do you get when you put the two of those things together? Water, which is the basis of our chemistry, which is the basis of an awful lot of chemistry, which is why it's the definition of what an acid and base is. Water auto-ionizes at any temperature. So let me put a note in here. Based on water. Let's discuss this auto-ionization of water. It's an equation that can be written like this. Where one molecule of water dissociates into the H plus and OH minus ions. Would you expect this as a favorable process or unfavorable process? In other words, does this have a positive delta G or a negative delta G? Positive. Positive delta G means favorable or unfavorable? Unfavorable. And why might it be unfavorable? Because it costs a lot more energy to break the bond that's there, that bond dissociation energy. Costs more to do that than the energy you get back by surrounding the ions, the energy of hydration. Yes?
Auto-ionization, is that why when you put electricity in water?
There will be some conductivity. More the reason that happens is because most water has stuff dissolved in it. If you get tap water, there's lime, there's things that have calcium ions. Those ions are what really contribute to the conductivity. Absolutely pure water, there's some small amount of conductivity, but technically, and I wouldn't try this my own self, technically you could be in a tub of completely pure distilled water, put electricity through it, and you'd be fine, just because there's not quite enough ions for there to be conductivity. There was some kind of Mythbusters show that was based on exactly that. So that's what I can't quite remember what the results were, but it was something along the lines of that, yes, in absolutely pure water, you'd be fine. But like I said, I don't think I want to try that anytime soon. That was one of the cooler things that have happened to me since I've been here, by the way. I don't remember how many years ago it was, but the Mythbusters came here to the Flint Center, and they were calling around. It's like, well, who should we have as the MC for that evening? And they're like, well, there's this chemistry prof down at DeAnza. Maybe you should give him a call. So I'm like, well, you want to come be the host for the Mythbusters? I'm like, well, let me think about that.
Yeah.
No, but I got to be the one that was asking them the questions on stage. Yeah, I got to meet them back. Nice enough people, you know, the one. He was actually really nice in real life, you know? So. Anyways, back on track here. If this is unfavorable, then why does it happen? Why is there a non-zero concentration of ions in solution? This will be the 5,003rd time that you've seen this graph. The The short way to answer it is, if equilibrium can happen, it will happen. Have I used that sentence yet? Oh, I will be. If equilibrium can happen, it will happen. If you have a reversible process, it's going to try to establish equilibrium. It's related to that lowest point on the reaction progress diagram that shows that equilibrium is the lowest energy point in a reversible process. If you only have reactants, you only have a forward reaction, so it's going to try to reach equilibrium. If you only have products, you only have the reverse reaction, so it's going to try to reach equilibrium. So if equilibrium can happen, it will happen. Why does it happen in this case? Why do we have any dissociation whatsoever? Because if this line that I drew here represents bond dissociation energy, and technically it represents really the energy once you take into account that there is a little bit of benefit you'll get back when the ions dissolve, but it's small enough that let's just call this bond dissociation energy. We look at the number of molecules versus how much energy per molecule there is. Then even at room temperature, there is some fraction of molecules that have the energy to be able to dissociate. And if we increase that temperature, then that is going to increase the molecules that have enough energy to be able to dissociate. So this section here is the fraction of molecules with enough energy to dissociate. And so since there's automatically these H plus and OH minus ions in solution, and since a lot of fundamental chemistry is based around these H plus and OH minus ions, that's why we have this narrow definition of what Arrhenius acids and bases are. I say narrow because not all compounds that eventually make H plus in solution have H plus as part of their molecular structure. Not all compounds that produce OH minus in solution have OH minus as part of their structure. Ammonia, a base that we'll get to in just a moment, very common base, reacts with acids, doesn't directly make OH when it dissociates. So that's why this is the narrowest definition of what acids and bases are. We had pH mentioned as something that's related to acids and bases earlier, so maybe we should take the time to go ahead and define pH. But since this is Chem 1C and not Chem 1A, I can say that there is an equilibrium constant for this dissociation to make H plus and OH minus, which, following the normal pattern of not including pure liquids in the equilibrium expression, I'm going to leave water out of it, and so this Kw, as it's called, looks very much like Ksp. H plus concentration times OH minus concentration equals 1.0 times 10 to negative 14th molar squared at a particular temperature, which, gosh, I do this every year. I forget to look up what temperature that is. I don't remember if it's room temperature, 0 degrees, some other random temperature, but some common temperature. But this value is only true at this one temperature. And I'll come back to talk about what that means in a second. So pH is defined as the negative base 10 log of the H plus ion concentration. In pure water, at the right temperature, well, actually, that's a misleading statement. In pure water, the H plus ion concentration is equal to the OH minus concentration. That's true regardless of temperature. But at the right temperature, both of those values are equal to 1.0 times 10 to the negative 7th molar. Why? Because if the H plus ion concentration is the same as the OH minus concentration, you stick it into this Kw expression, take the square root, and you get that H plus is equal to that concentration. Then if you stick it into the pH expression, negative base 10 log of 1.0 times 10 negative 7th. Law of logs say that if you take a product and you then take the log of it, you add the individual logs of the numbers. Log of 1 is 0, so 0 plus log of 10 to the negative 7th is what we're worried about. Well, log of a number that's a base that's the same as the log means we just take the exponent as the answer. So log to the base 10 of 10 to the negative 7th is negative 7. There's a negative in front of the whole darn equation, which means this whole thing is equal to 7, which is why we usually say that this is what we define as neutral. Because neutral, the definition is equal concentration of H plus and OH minus, not equal concentration of acid and base. Why is it not the same thing to say equal concentration of H plus and OH minus versus equal concentration of acid and base? They might not dissociate at least the same amount. In other words, what could we say about the strength of the acids and bases? That maybe we'll have weak acids and bases, which are weak electrolytes, which don't dissociate as much, which means you don't get the same concentrations of H plus and OH minus. So when we talk about titration curves on Monday, then we'll talk about how when we take a weak acid and a strong base, we're going to get a basic solution. Kind of like the same discussion I think we had maybe as I was introducing the topic of equilibrium. So we're going to be coming back to that discussion of acid and base strength. Question, yes?
It also would be confusing because lots of reactions just conjugate acids and conjugate
bases. We're going to talk about conjugate acids and bases and all that. That's part of our review. Maybe it won't get to it today, but we'll come back and address that, yes. Because there are acids that can dissociate more than once. And so then it gets even more complicated when talking about conjugates. Now, there's another aspect I want to come back to that I said that pH 7 is what normally is considered neutral. Is pH 7 always neutral? Why not? I saw some people go like that, and you're right. Yes. Because at different temperatures, the pH changes. If this graph shows you that because this is high temperature and this is low temperature, this graph shows that at different temperatures, there's a different number of molecules that are dissociating. Well, then this Kw changes. In fact, to refresh a little bit of Chem 1B, what is the only thing that can change an equilibrium constant? If you change the concentration of something in solution, will it change the equilibrium constant? No, it'll just rebalance the concentration of the other things in solution. What is the only thing that changes an equilibrium constant? Temperature. And so if we change the temperature, Kw is going to change. It's not equal to 10 to the negative 14th, which means when you solve for the H plus concentration, even in neutral water, it's not going to give you a pH value of 7. So pH 7 is only neutral at one temperature, since the value of Kw changes with temperature. Questions up to this point. Now, I've spent a lot of time talking about Arrhenius acids and bases. Let's briefly contrast with what are Bronsted-Lowry acids and bases. What is an acid in the Bronsted-Lowry definition? It's a proton donator. proton being a shorthand word for H+. Why would we use the word proton to refer to H+? Well, hydrogen, the most common form of hydrogen, only has a proton and an electron in the entire atom. Of course, there's deuterium and tritium, which have neutrons also. But 90-something percent of hydrogen is just hydrogen 1. And so, again, hydrogen only has proton and electron. If you make it a positively charged ion, then all that's left is the nucleus with the proton. And so that's why we refer to its H+ as a proton. So an acid donates a proton. What must a base be then? It accepts a proton. And this is the definition we tend to use more frequently, because I can make a statement like this. Ammonia is a Bronsted-Lowry base, but not an Arrhenius base, because it does not dissociate to produce OH-. Not directly. If you throw it in water, it'll make ammonium hydroxide. It will cause hydroxide to form, but it doesn't have it as part of its molecular structure. Now, for acids, though, all Arrhenius acids are, by definition, Bronsted-Lowry acids. Because if a Bronsted-Lowry acid is something that donates H+, and if Arrhenius acid has to dissociate to make H+, well, then that ends up being the same thing. So all Bronsted-Lowry acids are Arrhenius acids, and vice versa, the other way around. One last definition, Lewis acids and bases. Which we're not going to work much with in this chapter, but still good to know. What is an acid in the Lewis definition? It is an electron pair acceptor. And a base, it donates an electron pair. If we draw a map of a reaction showing how electrons move, then it helps us understand this definition. What I'm drawing here to the right is a set of arrows that is normally found in organic chemistry. They're what are known as mechanism arrows, and they show the flow of electrons in a chemical reaction. It is the framework by which we try to understand modern organic chemistry. In the old days, before we had any good sense of molecular shape and structure, a lot of organic chemistry was guesswork or memorization or just by testing. And then eventually we were able to figure out patterns of reactivity that led to figuring out these things called mechanisms. So if you look at the bottom there, I have a hydroxide ion, and I'm showing the lone pairs available on the hydroxide ion. And you see that one of those lone pairs is attacking H+. So the base is donating a lone pair. The H+, the acid, is accepting that lone pair. So hydroxide fits the definition of a Lewis base, and H+ fits the definition of a Lewis acid. Now look at these examples above it. Ammonia, NH3, and a molecule called borane, B-O-R-A-N-E. Highly reactive molecule because it does not have an octet. It is synthesizable. It exists. It's not boron's fault it doesn't have enough electrons to make an octet, but that does mean the compound's really reactive. So it will react with practically any lone pair source it can get its hands on. So if you see ammonia there, it's donating a lone pair into boron. But there's no H+ involved, there's no OH- involved. But we will refer to those things as Lewis acids and bases. because what we normally think of as acids and bases, OH and H+, can react with Lewis acids and bases. So there is some crossover there. There's some justification for why we call these electron donating and accepting events basicity and acidity. But, again, for our chapter, we're going to be limited to Arrhenius, or even more generally to Bronsted-Lowry acids and bases. So, are there any questions on the definitions of acids and bases before we move on to working our way slowly up to ice problems? Okay. We have discussed electrolytes this quarter. And we can now talk about how acids can be considered strong or weak electrolytes. So what I'm now leading up to is this thing called the Ka. And I'll do the same classical presentation that normally happens at this point. We start out with a monoprotic acid. What does monoprotic mean? Yes, dissociates to produce only one H+. Nitric acid, acetic acid, hydrochloric acid, those would be example of monoprotic acids. Sulfuric acid would be diprotic because it can produce two H pluses. Phosphoric, triprotic. So this monoprotic acid that can dissolve separately from whether or not it dissociates. Maybe it does dissociate to make H plus and A minus in solution. If this is the acid, then what it produces after it dissociates is known as the conjugate base. We could also call this thing the base that's produced, and this is the conjugate acid. We care about the relationship between these two things because, as I'm going to demonstrate in a moment, there is a relationship between the strength of an acid and its conjugate base. But we need a few numbers before we start talking about concepts like that. This is an equilibrium, meaning it's going to dissociate to make enough ions so that the ions trying to come back together, that rate equals the rate of dissociation. Since all of these things are in aqueous solution, at least the type of acid-base chemistry we're talking about, that means when we write the equilibrium constant, we put everything into it. So that is the acid dissociation constant. If K is much greater than 1, that means that delta G is much less than 0, and so this is a strong acid. Delta G being less than 0 means the association is favorable. HCl, for example, would have a very negative free energy of dissociation. In that case, making the ions really is favorable compared to breaking the HCl bond. If it's really favorable to dissociate, that means you've got mostly the ions, not much of the original acid left. So that's heavy dissociation. That's the definition of a strong acid. Yes? Much greater than, much less than. Other way around, if K is much less than 1, that means it doesn't want to dissociate much at all. And the reason it wouldn't dissociate much at all is because it's got a positive free energy. Remember the delta G is equal to negative RT ln of K equation. That's what lets us relate these things. This would be for a weak acid. Let's say that we wanted to calculate the H plus concentration that is present at equilibrium. And let's take, for our example, acetic acid. And I'll tell you that for acetic acid, the Ka value is equal to 1.76 times 10 to the negative fifth. It's the only value I've ever memorized because I use acetic acid all the time as my example. Let's say that we're given a 1.0 molar solution. Let's calculate the pH. Okay, what are we going to do this? The way you probably learned is you figure out what your initial set of conditions are as if the acetic acid just magically teleported into water and had not had a chance to achieve equilibrium yet. We then say, all right, it's going to try to achieve equilibrium, which means some of the concentrations are going to change. And after that change, we'll have some ending set of concentrations. That's why this is referred to as an ice problem, or at least that's the title that I learned. Maybe you learned different terminology, but it's that set of ideas that we're operating under. Pretend the solution really is acetic acid. Recognize that it's going to achieve equilibrium, so things are going to change. And then we need to try to figure out what are those ending concentrations. So I have the three things in solution that we care about, the acetic acid, the acetate, and the H+. Let's see what that initial concentration would be. What would be, again, pretending that the acetic acid just teleported into solution, what would be the initial concentration? 1.0, exactly the concentration that we're given. If it has not yet had a chance to dissociate, and if this is pure water that we're putting it into, what should the acetate concentration be? Zero. And the H plus concentration, if we haven't had dissociation of the acetic acid yet, should be equal to 10 to the negative 7. Because water auto-ionizes at any temperature. Does it make sense to include the 10 to the negative 7 value? Not in this case, but if we had a weak enough acid or a low enough concentration, then we can't ignore the 10 to the negative 7 anymore. So there are some shortcuts and simplifications that we take depending on what type of solution that we have. We're not ready to even have this discussion yet, but some of you might have learned the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. There are certain situations in which you are allowed to use it in certain situations where it's not appropriate to use, also because of the type of equilibria that will happen in solution. So I'm going to put here that this is technically the value. And I'll say that that is assumed to be zero if the acid is strong enough or concentrated enough. Now, how are these values going to change? Well, the acetic acid is going to dissociate. If you only have reactants, it's going to make products. So forward reaction. That means that the H plus concentration is going to go up by that same stoichiometric factor, because that's why I chose a monoprotic acid dissociating to start with. There is a 1:1:1 stoichiometric relationship between everything in solution. The acetate, we make one acetate for every H plus, and so that will also get a plus X. So our final concentrations are 1.0 minus X, X, and X. These we put into the equilibrium expression. So H plus ion concentration happens to be the same as the acetate concentration. That whole thing is divided by 1 over X, and that's equal to 1.76 times 10 to the negative 5. So rewriting the equation, well, I won't quite do that yet. Rewriting the equation, we have a quadratic. But there's a simplification that many times we can make. What is that? Ignore the X that's in the denominator. When are we allowed to do that? When X is small enough. Now, there's some other rule, and I forget without looking what it is, something about equilibrium constants divided by each other equal to 100, or there's some specific expression that I'll teach you on Monday when we're ready for it. But the short version is, if X gets too big, then you can't ignore it because it's really going to have an impact on that denominator. I know that when we solve this problem, we're going to get an X that is small enough that it's within about 1% of that 1, and so then we can ignore it. And again, knowing that what the answer is going to be in this case, I'll go ahead and ignore it. So that we'll say that the Ka is approximately equal to x squared over 1, which is equal to 1.76 times 10 to the 5, which means x in this case is equal to 4.20 times 10 to the -3. That is less than 1% of 1, so that means we were justifiable in ignoring it. Now, because I've mentioned the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation, I'll say that for exactly the same reason we can ignore x here, we're able to use the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation in this case. If we couldn't ignore x, those are also the same situations where we can't use the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. Now, if this is x, what we're really looking for is pH, which is going to be the negative base 10 log of 4.20 times 10 to the negative 3, which is equal to, what is it, sorry? 2.38. Great. But we're supposed to be talking about buffer solutions, aren't we? But we are doing review to get to that point. So there's one more step along the way. And thankfully, actually Monday, I forgot, we're not supposed to be doing titration curves yet. We're supposed to be doing buffer solution workshop. So we got plenty of time still to talk about buffer solutions. What we need to see now is what happens to this pH if we suddenly add some base, some strong base like sodium hydroxide. There we go. If we're given a mixture where we start out with 10 milliliters of 0.2 molar acetic acid and react that with 10 milliliters of 0.4 molar sodium hydroxide, calculate the pH. This is a special kind of problem because, yes, we have a weak acid, but fortunately, we're reacting it with a strong base. And so here's what we assume. We assume that the strong base hydroxide entirely reacts with acetic acid. Why? Because when it reacts with acetic acid, it'll make water. And the hydroxide effectively just disappears. all that you're left with is acetic acid and acetate, which means we could use the same Ka expression as we did before. Now, if this was a weak acid and a weak base, it's a more complicated problem. But for buffer solutions, we're going to be talking about exactly this situation, how to resist the effects of strong acids and strong bases. So, the approach taken for the neutralization of a weak acid with a strong base is to assume the two completely react, then re-achieve equilibrium. What do I mean by assume they completely react? Well, let's figure out how many moles of stuff we've got. So acetic acid, we have 0.050 liters times the 0.2 molar, which means we've got 0.010 moles acetic acid. For the sodium hydroxide, there's 0.010 liters of it times its concentration of 0.4 molar, and so we've got 0.004 moles sodium hydroxide. Well, I'm going to assume that all of the hydroxide reacts with acetic acid. So the acetic acid left is going to equal that 0.010 moles minus the 0.004 moles, which means we have 0.006 moles acetic acid remaining. The hydroxide completely disappears. We pretend it completely neutralizes, and then we worry about the solution forming equilibrium. But that means that we have acetate and that's equal to the moles of sodium hydroxide used, which is going to be equal to 0.004 moles. Why are we doing this calculation? Again, to simplify the problem. When we're doing one of these ice problems, we want to use one equilibrium constant. I want to use the equilibrium constant that shows what's happening to this acetic acid and acetate in solution. I don't want to have to worry about hydroxide also. And I don't have to worry about hydroxide if I let it completely react first. So that's why we're doing the problem the way that we're doing it. Now, we still need these initial concentrations then for acetic acid and acetate. And so the initial concentration of acetic acid is equal to the number of moles left over divided by the total solution volume. Where this is where a mistake is often made. If you're given two different solutions, you got to remember that the solution volume has changed. So use that total solution volume in your calculation of concentration, which in this case works out to be really simple. It is 0.1 molar. Then acetate, the conjugate base, its initial concentration is 0.004 moles divided by that same volume, so it's 0.066 molar. Now we can solve the problem in exactly the same way. We again look at that dissociation that's occurring. We make acetate And the H plus ion will just plug in the 0.1 molar, the 0.066 molar, and then zero again for the concentration of H plus. Now, we'll assume that some more dissociation of acetate's going to happen for the moment. So that'll go down by X. These other two values will go up by X. So our initial, our change, and then we get the end value, which is going to be 0.1 minus X, 0.006 plus X, and X. We throw these things into a Ka expression. So we get X times 0.066 plus X over 0.1 minus X. That's equal to 1.76 times 10 to the negative 5. And before I post the notes up, I'll give us the value of X and give us the pH. But what's going to be obvious, hopefully, is that that pH should be higher than the solution of acetic acid on its own. Reason I wanted to go through this problem is show us how to do a neutralization problem. Also show us that we're going to end up in cases like this, where even if we can make... where it remains to be seen until I do that calculation whether we can ignore X or not. But I don't want to take the time now because we're right up at the end of class. I want to talk about where we're going to go next. In this case, we started out with acetic acid and caused it to neutralize. That's going to hopefully have an obvious change on its pH. But what if we already had some of the base present even before we added the hydroxide? Let me tie this in, and I know this is coming out of the blue, it seems like. But what if we were titrating acetic acid? So if we looked at how much sodium hydroxide that we added versus the pH of the system. We didn't calculate the pH of a 0.2 molar concentration of acetic acid, but we did calculate the pH for a 1 molar, and that was 2.38. So that we know that the solution will start out somewhere with a low pH value. As we add base, there is going to be a sort of initial increase, and then it will plateau a bit, we will find out. That slope then dramatically increases, and then eventually levels off yet again. It is at this steepest point of the curve that we say that the equivalence point occurs. Which, since we had that discussion, didn't we? Of what equivalence point versus end point is, we know that's where the moles of acid and base are equal. We're going to come to the point where we discuss this thing right here, the half equivalence point. Because if we make certain simplifications, there's something special that happens mathematically at that point. You notice also, though, around that, that's where the pH doesn't change very much. And that's the area that is called the buffer region. So what we're going to do is do one more ice problem to start with on Monday, where we have a solution where we already have some acid and base around, some acid and its conjugate base around. Then we'll see that when we add a strong base to it, the pH doesn't change a lot, which is the whole point of what a buffer solution is.